Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a packed show. We chat with short story writer Nathan Englander about his new collection.
Which Gentiles would hide us in the event of a second Holocaust? And about 20 years ago or something, my sister said about a couple we knew, he would hide us and she would turn us in.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. The Times' chief art critic Roberta Smith tells us about a remarkable German artist.
Every exhibition he had was an occasion for some kind of slightly perverse publication. He constantly recycled found objects, his own work through his work, and he fueled this entire career with a great deal of alcohol.
Gina Belafonte is here to talk about the latest edition of the Big City Book Club, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. Nathan Englander is one of America's most honored and inventive short story writers. He's got a new collection called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, which is going to give us a lot to talk about. It's reviewed for us by the Pulitzer Prize winning and best-selling author Stacey Schiff, who says it's a terrific collection. And get this, in it, you will hear echoes of the two Isaacs, Bathsheba Singer and Isaac Babel. That's pretty high praise. I'm delighted that Nathan is joining us from the great city of Seattle. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Nathan, what do we talk about when we talk about Anne Frank?
This book, I've been spent the last couple of years, two or three years, working on a play which is opening to the public in the fall, and this translation of the Haggadah, which is coming out next month.
Now, Nathan, when you say the public, you mean the Public Theater in Manhattan, is that right?
Yes, sir, with Hare and Chorus Line and Shakespeare in the Park, Joe Papp's Public. The point is, I spent the last 3 years working at projects by which I do not identify, and something changed in me. This idea of putting all the effort that I put into fiction writing, but you know, I know Constance Garnett. You know, that's my idea of a translator. I just didn't have any of the other static, and I was focused deeply on these projects, and it just tripped something. Some idea of identity and ownership and freedom, and I working with words, but in this new way, just reminded me of my beginnings, and it reminded me of what I care about with writing. And again, I hadn't been working on a book that people weren't tapping their foot and waiting for in a while. There I was, you know, sort of in secret writing these stories. The point is, there was this game that I thought was a game that we only played in my house that my sister invented, I now know different, where we called it the Righteous Gentile game or the Who Would Hide Me game or the Anne Frank game, basically. The idea, in the event of a second Holocaust, which I was raised to believe was always a possibility, and you know, people will say it is a possibility or it is not as they listen on their podcast, and we would say, who would hide us? Which Gentiles would hide us in the event of a second Holocaust? And about 20 years ago or something, my sister said about a couple we knew, he would hide us, and she would turn us in. And it was just a, you know, just an observation, and I thought about it, and I thought, and when I thought about this couple, I thought, he would hide us, and she would turn us in. It's true. That's how they're built, I think. I really believed it. And, you know, I carried it around in my head for 20 years, and then I stepped back from this thing that's totally normal to me, and then I looked at it and saw how deeply twisted and pathological it was. And the point is, I started building it into a story, and you know, suddenly there are two couples, and suddenly they're both Jewish, and then one couple turns Hasidic. And as it takes shape, I just was looking into memory, in a sense. Why I believe in books, why I love fiction so much, because nothing else turns. You know, movies, you can remember seeing a movie, and you can remember hearing a song, but fiction, you know, story turns into actual memory. And I hadn't read The Carver, the legendary Carver masterpiece, what we talk about when we talk about love. I just probably, you know, maybe America's most legendary story, at least of the last, you know, 30 years or something. But I thought about that story, and everything had turned into dust in that story, except I had one memory of two couples at a table, a bottle of gin between them, and the changing light of the day. And I just decided to marry my story to the legendary story.
Nathan, we know that a number of really extraordinary writers today, you're one, another is the great Norwegian novelist Per Pettersen, a third is the extraordinary Japanese writer Haruki Murakami, admire Raymond Carver, maybe above all other recent American writers. What's the power there? Why Carver?
I'm a nice Jewish boy. I'm like, no, I must not leave out the others. Now I just want to scream Cheever, Flannery O'Connor. You know, I just want to list, you know, Laurie Moore's stories. Let's not forget, you know, people like that are the only people here. I just want to list stories for you now. But yes, the Carver thing, I don't know, it's funny because you get back this idea of people talking about, you know, the editor and where's Carver's voice in this. I don't know. I know the Carver stories that I know in the edited form, you know, in which I know them. But the point is those stories, there's something about that voice, the true intimacy of it, the erasure of space. It's the way, you know, voice enters your ear, and it's like a story being told by a friend. And I feel like Carver, just there's this honesty to it that really touches me. I almost never cry from fiction. I can't even tell you. I'm trying to think of someone else, but A Small Good Thing, Cathedral, like I read Cathedral and I cry, and then I'm almost mad at myself. I'm like, what? You brought in the blind man, you're pressing my butt. You know, I want to look at the structure of it even and say I shouldn't get hit this way, but there's just something so honest and raw. You know, he is the man who can bring me to tears.
Nathan, I want to ask you about another really superb story in your collection, that new collection that Stacey Schiff mentions. It's called Camp Sundown, and it includes some of the themes you've been mentioning so far: memory, the Holocaust, and games that aren't really funny, the way history can take over people's minds, memories can haunt them. Talk a little bit about this tale.
Yeah, Camp Sundown, it's funny. I think of my girlfriend's father. He was in town when I was just had finished a draft, and one of those moments where you finish a draft and hand it to someone. But, I saw him out there laughing, and then he came in and gave me that look and said, you know I should never trust you, you know, that this story's not going to turn out funny in the end. But, I guess it's basically about an elder hostel set up. It's a camp that there's a child side of the camp and then an old people's camp, a Jewish camp up in the Berkshires. And the campers, they become convinced that one of the other campers among them is sort of a Demjanjuk, is an old Nazi who's living, as I say, sort of a blue-toed, diabetic, you know, low-sodium diet Jew, and has decided to, you know, live out his days hiding among the people he persecuted. And they're really convinced this is the man from the camps, and they are after justice.
And one of the powerful things in the story, Nathan, is we're not really given any evidence that he is this villain from the true camps, the extermination camps. Why are they convinced? They recognize him? They remember him? Are their memories playing tricks? Is he lying? What's going on?
I just feel like that's life. You know what I'm saying? This is big choices are made on bad information, and it's hard to tell what people's true motivations are, what they really know. That's the point of story, where I feel like the whole world lives at these rules, and many lives are lost and many decisions are made. And I feel like that's what story allows, is us to look at it. And I guess I'm just obsessed with the gray space in life. I'm sort of tortured by the idea where Obama, you know, having Osama bin Laden killed. People are cheering in the streets, and this is a man, you know, who got what he deserved by any measure of justice. But the idea to say, oh, there's no courts who are dealing with this, therefore I'm going to kill someone. This happens in the world, and I'm sort of obsessed with that. So, yes, if you found an old, like, what would it be? You know, when does justice end? When can it? It's not for me to say whether they're, you know, I feel like the stories, and this book especially, more than I think anything I've ever written, it's functioning like a Rorschach test to me. You know, people come to me and read the same story and tell me opposite reads, you know, as this is, you know, this is the statement this is making. So, yeah, it's not even for me to say whether they're right or it's dementia or justice is delivered or if a murder has taken place. I mean, that's what fiction does. You know, again, as a reader, what I love as a reader is there aren't answers to the questions that I'm interested in. I just love reading. As a reader, I love the books, Kafka, Conrad, Camus. I love the people who aren't afraid to wrestle with the questions and face how terrifying they are.
Nathan, in another great story that sort of skirts this line you often do between sort of the horrific and the tragic and the wry and the comic, there are two men who turn out to have concentration numbers, tattoos on their arms that are three digits apart and are brought together and that this historical thing would seem to unite them, but then it doesn't.
That's the title story, what we talk about when we talk about Anne Frank, and the American wife is very moved, always, you know, that's sort of the split in the story. I'm very interested in how there is the historical fact of the Holocaust, there is the legacy that we live with, and then I'm interested in ownership of those ideas or how people use them to say this is, you know, Israel's doing this because of this legacy, or I almost feel like there's like a second Simon Wiesenthal Center, even as someone who writes about the Holocaust, where there's like the Nazi hunters and the Nazi reference hunters. You know, so my point is, this woman's expecting a very moving Holocaust story, and it's really about this amazing small twist of fate of two people ending up in Florida who were clearly online together at Auschwitz, and neither of them cares. And that's, you know, sort of the point of that moment. She's deeply disappointed. But that's based on, it's my brother-in-law's family. You know, my family's been here a very long time, but my brother-in-law's father is an Auschwitz survivor, as is, you know, the story is from his sister, from Aunt Gloria. But I think they were at some bar mitzvah or wedding in Florida, you know, and literally somebody noticed in the room. I just, again, another story that was in my head for a decade. But there she was in the room with someone whose number was very close to hers. And I couldn't shake the idea of how worlds move. I mean, what does that take? It's from infinity. And those things are both deeply moving to me, or as in this story, can be presented as to the people involved. Maybe not so moving.
Thanks so much, Nathan.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's Nathan Englander, whose new book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. So, Julie, hot off the presses or off the blog or whatever, does Amanda Knox's memoir have a publisher?
She does indeed. After a very heated auction this week, Amanda Knox has sold the rights to her memoir to HarperCollins for about $4 million.
How do we know it was $4 million?
We have sources familiar with the negotiations.
How many publishers were involved in what we'll call the serious auction here? This is one of these deals where Amanda Knox has a very high-powered representative, Robert Barnett from Washington, who normally is handling presidential memoirs and such, and he meets with, what, a selected group of publishers?
So this is sort of an old-fashioned auction, as Bob Burnett likes to run it. A few weeks ago, Amanda Knox came to New York. She met with about a half dozen publishers, all of the big ones, HarperCollins, of course, Random House, Simon & Schuster, Macmillan. And those publishers were hand-selected by Bob Burnett and the family. Then a few weeks go by, and the publishers think about how much they want to bid on this book. And this week, the auction happened. And basically, everyone submits their bids, and there's just a lot of back and forth until the winner emerges.
So, Julie, make sure I understand this. So when Amanda Knox is meeting with the publishers, is Barnett in the room too? Is he there as a kind of agent or representative for her?
The publishers I talked to said that she didn't bring along a family member, that Mr. Barnett was there with her. And these meetings generally involve, the author, Amanda Knox in this case, talking about what kind of book they want to write. And Amanda Knox said that she wanted to do a very high-quality book, that the quality was very important to her, that she had been keeping diaries from the 4 years that she spent in prison in Italy. You know, she talked about things like the literary novels that she loved, that, she talked about her experience in prison. And the people I talked to said that they were completely charmed by her.
And so then the meeting lasts, let's say it's an hour and a half or something. Then the publishers huddle among themselves and then present a bid to the agent, Mr. Barnett, or he says, establishes a floor, you know, you have to bid at least $2 million or something like that. And then in the course of the week, he fields morbids? I mean, they're not holding up placards like at Christie's or Sotheby's, right?
Right. This doesn't all happen at lunch at Michael's, although Mr. Burnett might appreciate it if it worked that way. But yeah, there's just a lot of back and forth. So let's say a publisher offers $3 million, and then the number just keeps ticking up as you know, the agent goes back and forth to the publishers. And eventually, you know, when a publisher kind of reaches the ceiling, let's say they don't want to go past 3.5, then they drop out at that point.
Now, Julie, not to get too much into the weeds of all this, but we kind of assume that a memoir like Ms. Knox's will have an international audience. Let's say in England, where the poor young woman, Meredith Kircher, came from, who was killed, and in Italy, where Amanda Knox became this figure of cultural fascination, they'll be interested in an edition of the book there as well. Does that mean that the publisher who's bidding, that HarperCollins is offering $4 million, do they control the rights to all those different editions so that they see a plausible way to earn back this investment they've made?
In this case, it is believed that that Mr. Burnett was offering world rights rather than simply North American rights. So when you're offering up that $4 million, you're also getting the rights to publish the book in Italy and in Britain. But it's an interesting question because Amanda Knox is not a popular person in the UK. Meredith Kircher, the woman who was murdered, who is a roommate of Amanda Knox, is from the UK.
And her family is very skeptical about Amanda Knox's innocence.
Yes. Her family, the Kircher family, was quite convinced that Amanda Knox and her former boyfriend, Raffaele Sollecito, were guilty of this murder. So if you're the publisher, you have to ask yourself, how many people in the UK are going to be lining up to buy this book when public opinion of Amanda Knox is very unsympathetic? And it's also the case in Italy. You know, most Italian journalists who covered the case back in 2009 when she was originally convicted of murder believed that she did it. Now, the American public is a different story. I think that people here are generally sympathetic to her. However, it's not a clear-cut case as it is in some other cases of books, say, by J.C. Dugard, the woman in California who was kidnapped and held for 17 years and had two children while she was held captive. That book sold, I think, something like 1.5 million copies after it came out last year. And that was a very clear-cut case of someone who was a pure victim.
A victim and survivor. And in the case of Amanda Knox, then I suppose some of the suspense will hover around how convincing a case she makes in this book for her innocence. However literary she means it to be, however much a prison diary, that's what people like us and many other readers, I would think, or producers and 60 Minutes or whatever big interview programs we assume will be talking to her, they're going to be weighing that question then?
And I think a lot of it will depend on how well she comes across in those TV interviews that she will undoubtedly do in the lead up to the book release. In the J.C. Dugard example, she went on Diane Sawyer's evening news program, and it was a massively watched program. I think 15 million people watched that show, and that just set off this avalanche of book sales. And I know that publishers who really wanted the Amanda Knox book, you know, looked at that as an example. So a lot of the success of this book, whenever it does come out, will really depend on how Amanda Knox presents herself in those interviews.
So in some way, the jury is still out.
Very much.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
15 years after his death, the remarkable German artist Martin Kippenberger remains a huge cultural figure, and there's a huge new book about him. It's called Kippenberger, The Artist and His Families, plural, by Suzanne Kippenberger. It's reviewed for us by the great Roberta Smith, chief art critic for the New York Times. She's here to talk about it. Welcome, Roberta.
Thank you, Sam.
So briefly, who was this comet, as you say, who streaked across the sky?
Well, he was this. He was one of a generation of very talented German artists who was born after the war, unlike some of the bigger names we already know, Sigmar Polka or Gerhard Richter. And he had this intensely varied, intensely productive, intensely controversial, and slightly obnoxious career. He always wanted to be an artist, but he started out running a club in Berlin where films and performances were given. And then he turned to painting, he made sculpture, he sort of touched on every art movement of the 20th century. He worked in photography, performance, he produced lots of books. Every exhibition he had was an occasion for some kind of slightly perverse publication. He constantly recycled found objects, his own work through his work. And he fueled this entire career with a great deal of alcohol that ultimately killed him.
Kippenberger was born shortly after World War II. He comes of age in a Germany that's dealing with this tremendous trauma. He's part of a generation of very driven, and you use the word more than once, of perverse tastes and aesthetics. And also you say he lived an extreme artist's life. I mean, is this like stuff we don't even want to know about, or the kind of thing that we're used to from a downtown art scene, even in New York?
Well, I think that we're probably used to it more from the lives led by the abstract expressionists. And, you know, I draw the analogy with de Kooning. I mean, this was someone who drank morning, noon, and night most of his life. He would go to the spa. He would have little periods of drying up. But I think it's an extreme version. It probably has something to do with the nature of the role of alcohol in German culture being more freely used. It's more freely used than I think it is here.
How is he so productive? How did he do so much?
Well, one theory is that he had this incredible constitution, and that alcohol was a kind of fuel, as a lubricant, as well as a liberator of his creative juices. And he also just got so many people involved. I mean, he was an incredibly gregarious man. As I said, he really never wanted to be alone, and he was constantly marshaling people, drafting people into the making of his art, in this kind of big participatory production. But Germany has an really unusual art scene in that they have a very organized, extremely productive system of schools. They have a great tradition of art dealers. And since, I would say, around 1965 or 70, they have just constantly produced generation after generation of interesting artists. And Kippenberger was on the cusp of this generation that came to the fore when Germany was in recovery, was really recovering economically, and was very kind of West Germany. Life was very comfortable there. And he became a critic of that in a certain way. He touched on lots of taboos in his art about the Nazi past. And he also, I mean, one of the things he did was buy a gas station in Brazil and name it the Martin Bormann's gas station so that Martin Bormann's would have a place to go.
You know, it reminds me a little bit, Roberta, of another great artist who died young and who was huge when I was coming of age in New York in the 1980s, Werner Fassbinder. This someone who brought a kind of huge critical intelligence to art and raised very difficult questions in his films. Was Kippenberger a really good artist? I mean, Fassbinder was a great filmmaker, we know. Is Kippenberger a really good artist? Or will we be looking at his work 10 years from now, or to someone like you who is kind of a maker of reputations? You see him as a great creative figure?
I see him really as a great artist. I see him as one of the two or three greatest artists to come out of Germany in the post-war period. For me, his work has this kind of amazingly invigorating ugliness to it. I mean, he was really kind of just mashing all these different ideas together. He worked abstractly. He worked with images. There's so much going on in his objects, and they're so kind of aggressive. They're a lot like him. They're very much in your face. And I think they have this vitality, this visual vitality that constantly questions your ideas. with a kind of ripple effect, where it first will question your idea about taste, and then about how artists reuse history, and then maybe history itself. So his work, he's done a lot of different kinds of work. He had a fantastic survey at the Museum of Modern Art in 2008.
Did he work in all the different forms, sculpture, painting?
He worked in every medium. And the most interesting thing about him that I found from this book, the really touching thing, was this kind of picture of his early life, which nobody had really detailed or could have detailed.
Well, tell us first who the author is.
Well, the author is his youngest sister. Kippenberger is the middle child of five children, all of whom but him are women. His parents were kind. His father was director of a coal mine. His mother was trained as a doctor, although she didn't practice until later. And they had this kind of somewhat stressful but idyllic childhood in a way, in that there was always stuff going on. There was a lot of family activities. The parents were very art-oriented, and I think he was highly competitive with his father, who was a failed artist. And you just get this sense of this kind of marvelous, incredibly stressful, formative childhood, where within the family itself, the kind of you feel like the lines between art and life were already erased when he was a child, and there were these constant parties, obviously a lot of drinking, a lot of kind of performances. His sister sort of portrays his life as an attempt to get back to this childhood, which I think it very much was, and that's part of the book's title, The Artist and His Families, and that he was constantly trying to, with his friends and with his various patrons, he was constantly trying to restructure, recreate this synergy and an incredibly loving but highly competitive environment that he had grown up with.
And Roberta, what's his influence today? Can you see the sons and daughters of Kippenberger?
Yeah, I like to think that all artists have their inner Kippenberger. I mean, I think that his sense of an artist had an adversarial relationship with society, that he was supposed to make people think, and that he was basically supposed to upset people. The other thing that I find really important, just in a kind of a more art historical way, is that he's very much influenced by conceptual art, by the notion that ideas are incredibly important, but his work always has this amazing physicality, very intense visuality, so that I like to think that the idea of putting ideas and visual forms together, really making them clash, is what he did and what his legacy will be.
Just a really remarkable figure. Thanks so much, Roberta.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Roberta Smith, chief art critic for The Times, who reviews Kippenberger, The Artist and His Families, in this week's book review. Well, The Times' zillions of listeners and readers and book lovers know about Genia Belafonte's Big City Book Club, and she's here to talk about it again. Welcome, Genia.
Thanks, Sam.
So how's it going, first of all? Have you gotten a good response, and how many books have you done?
We've done about four books since we began in September. We've gotten a great response, and we're finding that readers like to follow up after the conversation. We usually have a three-hour conversation every 6 weeks, and readers are really coming back to us online and wanting to talk more about the books we've been reading.
So what's up next? Who are you reading?
We have one of my all-time favorite comic novels, Don Powell's A Time to Be Born, which is a 1942 satire of the New York media world and the conniving striving and ambition that attends it. And it feels as though it could have been written about, you know, today.
Genia, some of our listeners may remember that Don Powell had kind of disappeared for a while, and then maybe in the 90s or so was rediscovered as this extraordinary voice. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, her books were out of print. They came back into print in the early 90s. She has had a huge advocate in Gore Vidal, who was a big champion and, you know, responsible for bringing a lot of attention back to her. And then most of the novels have been republished and are easy to find now.
And she wasn't a New Yorker, right? She's someone who moved to New York.
Yeah, she came from Ohio. And what's very funny about this book is it's about reinvention, coming to New York from the Midwest, reinventing oneself with a certain amount of shame. And the central character is a woman based on Claire Booth Luce, who keeps her Midwestern sort of low-rent roots under the cover and reinvents herself as a grand dame journalist and wife of a media baron.
Ginny, you use a very interesting word, shame. Why is shame involved in this?
The sense that she creates in the book is that money and status are really everything in New York, and if you don't have it, you're going to pretend to, and if you haven't had it before, you're going to not let anybody know that. And she's satirizing that idea, and that's the ugliness and humor surrounding the central character.
Boy, it sounds like a lot of fun.
It's terrific.
Thanks so much, Ginia.
Thanks.
Ginia Belafonte, who is the host of the New York Times' Big City Book Club. Gregory Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Sam.
So we have as much volatility in the bestseller lists as in the Republican primary campaign. What's going on?
Yeah, there are almost as many new books as there are candidates. We've got really almost a dozen new titles on the hardcover bestseller lists this week. There are 7 on the nonfiction side of things. At number 16 on the nonfiction list, there's a book called All There Is by Dave Isay. That's a compilation of love stories from his ongoing oral history project, StoryCorps, that gets played on National Public Radio. It's people going into a booth and telling stories about their lives. And he, in time for Valentine's Day, gathered a bunch of the love stories together into this book.
What else?
At number 15 is a book called Ally in Wonderland by the comedian and actress Ally Wentworth, who grew up in a political family. Her mom worked as the White House press person for Reagan.
Isn't she also married to George Stephanopoulos?
As a matter of fact, she is, yes. And so she talks about their marriage and about raising kids, that kind of thing. It's sort of a memoir and sort of one of these comic memoirs. So at number 14 is The Science of Yoga by William J. Broad.
Our colleague!
In fact, he's a science reporter here at the Times. He practices yoga himself. A part of this book was excerpted in the Times magazine talking about all of the risks that you put yourself at practicing yoga, the way that people can really hurt their bodies. It caused a lot of controversy inside the yoga community, but he also talks about the rewards of yoga.
I did a webcast with Bill Broad and for the Times, the Timescast, and he talked about just the ferocious reaction to what he's described. But I must say, some of the health risks he described are no joke. I mean, you really damage yourself doing this.
Yeah, I think people don't realize how strenuous it is, and they really push themselves too hard. My wife practices yoga, and one of her teachers out in Connecticut wrote a very strong reaction to his article on her Facebook page that got picked up and got some play. A lot of people inside the yoga community really took offense or said, sure, people hurt themselves, but it's because they don't know what they're doing and they try to do too much too soon. We've still got 4 to go on the nonfiction.
Let's hear them.
Up at number 9 is Catherine Boo's new book, Behind the Beautiful Forevers, that we reviewed on our cover a couple of weeks ago. She is a journalist. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and before that was at The Washington Post, a MacArthur genius, just like Dave Isay is. And she is reporting on a Mumbai slum, the lives of the people who live in the slum in Mumbai, focusing really on one person who ends up being accused of murder in a kind of bribery scam. One of his neighbors lights herself on fire, and the police accuse him of it as a way to kind of shake down his family for money.
Catherine Boo, I believe, is going to be doing a podcast with us at some point. And we know here at the Book Review and at the Times, and many people in the world of journalism know, this is really one of America's exceptional narrative nonfiction writers.
She's an amazing nonfiction writer. When she won the MacArthur, she was a staff writer for the Washington Post at the time, and people said, why is a journalist winning this award that really celebrates creativity? The Post defended her at the time, saying, you know, nobody writes this stuff like she does. She covered the poverty beat for them, and she just really got into these people's lives. She absents herself completely from it. Nothing she writes is formulaic. It's all very fly on the wall. And she just really gives you almost a novelistic portrait of the people she's writing about.
What else have we got, Greg?
At number 8 on the nonfiction list is Pamela Druckerman's Bringing Up Bebe, which is she's an American living in France. She's writing about differences in parenting styles.
Oh, they're better at that, too. Is that the argument here?
That is the argument, yes. They're less permissive, and they give more attention to what the parents need than what the children do. At number 7 is Mimi Alford's memoir, Once Upon a Secret, telling the story of her 18-month affair with John F. Kennedy. And at number 2 is Hilarity Ensues by Tucker Max. He's this guy who has this real persona. It's his 3rd bestseller, and they're all kind of bad boy drinking and having sex memoirs. He just tells funny story after funny story about women that he hooked up with and that whole milieu. I found an article with him in Forbes magazine last month where apparently he's 36 now, and he's just tired of this hard-partying lifestyle. He wants to give it all up. He has taken up yoga. He's stopped drinking as much beer. He's started drinking kombucha, exercising a lot, doing mixed martial arts. You know, he wants to find a nice girl and settle down.
So he's going to give up the hard-charging life and end up in traction because of yoga.
Because of the yoga, exactly.
How about fiction? What have we got? Maybe just a couple titles here.
There are 4 new titles on the list. They are all crime thriller books. At number 12 is Deborah Crombie's No Mark Upon Her. Crombie is an American who writes these British mysteries. Then at number 10, J.A. Jantz has a book called Left for Dead. At number 2, Lisa Gardner's book, Catch Me. At number 1, Vince Flynn, the CIA and military thriller writer, has a new book out called Kill Shot.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.